My father's comments range from, "You should have gotten that," to, "I would have gotten that." From our sofa, bowling looked easy, and we couldn't understand why so many contestants failed to win the jackpot. At the end of each show, viewers were encouraged to call the studio to become a contestant. My father gathered the courage to call and was invited to come for a trial run. Like a bride preparing to walk down the aisle, my father carefully chose his clothing, got a haircut, and practiced saying, "Hello, I am Kazem," to the bathroom mirror. My mother, now a self-declared bowling expert, gave him all kinds of advice. "Make sure you win." My father drove the hour-and-a-half round trip to the Burbank studio for the first trial run and returned feeling triumphant. He hadn't bowled any strikes, but he had been asked to return for the second practice. If the second practice went well, he would then appear on television. Another hour-and-a-half trip for the second practice, and he was selected to return for a taping of the show. My father was hoping that none of the contestants before him would win, so that the jackpot would be really big. He didn't want to merely win the jackpot. He wanted to win a huge one. The big day finally arrived, and my father was ready to strike it rich. He filled the Impala with gas and set off for the third and final drive to the studio. We waited anxiously at home. My father returned that night looking sadder than I had ever seen him. In his two tries, he had hit a total of only 7 pins, winning $7. He had never before bowled so poorly. He blamed his poor performance on everything from the lights to the long drive. We didn't care why he hadn't won. We just could not recall anybody winning so little on Bowling for Dollars. My father had spent several times as much on gasoline just driving back and forth to the studio. When the performance was aired a few weeks after the taping, we watched in silence. My father looked very nervous on television, especially after he hit his first gutter ball. After the second gutter ball, he looked positively panicked. After this brush with fame, we no longer watched Bowling for Dollars. We didn't feel the same emotional involvement. Who were we to criticize these people, all of whom managed to win more than $7? Shortly thereafter, my father gave up bowling entirely, deciding it was a stupid sport, if one could even call it a sport. More important, his Wednesday evening bowling nights had forced him to miss the Sonny and Cher comedy hour. Now he was able to squeeze onto the sofa with the rest of us and catch up. Save me, Mickey. When we first came to America in 1972, we knew we would be staying only for about 2 years. This gave us approximately 104 weekends to see everything there was to see in California. From Knott's Berry Farm to Marine World, from the Date Festival to the Garlic Festival, we saw it all. Along the way, we tasted garlic ice cream, date shakes, and cherry slushies, and other foods that we no longer remember, although we do recall the ensuing scrambles to the drugstore for Rolaids. Because we were new to this country, we were impressed not just by the big attractions, but also by the little things: smiling employees, clean bathrooms, and clear signage. Our ability to be impressed by the large selection of keychains at the souvenir shops guaranteed that every place we saw delighted us. There was, however, one attraction that stood apart, one whose sweatshirts we wore with pride, one that generated near religious devotion: Disneyland. My father believed that Walt Disney was a genius, a man whose vision allowed everyone, regardless of age, to relive the wonderment of childhood. Ask my father what he considers to be man's greatest creation in the 20th century, and he won't say computers, the Concorde, or knee replacement surgery. For him, Pirates of the Caribbean represents the pinnacle of man's creative achievement. No matter how many times my father goes on that ride, he remains as impressed as a Disneyland virgin. "Did you see that pirate leg hanging over the bridge? Could somebody remind me that it wasn't real? And the battle between the ships? Geez, was I the only one ready to duck and cover? What kind of man would think of creating something like this? A genius, that's who." I doubt that even Walt Disney's mother felt as much pride in her son as my father did. According to my father, any activity that is enjoyed by our family will be exponentially more enjoyable if shared with others. A crowded dinner at his sister's house, where only half the guests have chairs, is preferred to a meal with 4 people and ample seating. His tribal nature may result from having grown up with 8 siblings, but whatever the root cause, my father decided that if Disneyland was fun for our family, just think how much more fun it would be with 20 other people. That is how, one weekend, we found ourselves at Disneyland's main entrance with 6 of my father's Iranian colleagues and their families. I had already been to Disneyland 15 times and was, frankly, getting a little sick of the place. I knew every turn in every ride and all the punchlines to all the shows. But nonetheless, on yet another Saturday morning, I stood in front of Mr. Toad's Wild Ride with a large group of people, all oohing and aahing as my father, the self-appointed ambassador to the Magic Kingdom, pointed out fascinating tidbits. "See how people wait patiently in these long lines? In other countries, you'd have a fight, but not here. This is America." We roamed through Disneyland like a herd of buffalo, stopping only at the rides deemed worthy by my father. At one point, we found ourselves near the telephones where one could talk to Mickey Mouse. As my father was busy explaining the wonders of the nearby Monsanto ride with the big eyeball that looks positively real, I decided to experiment with the phones, which I had somehow never tried before. I picked up the receiver and discovered that there was no conversation with Mickey Mouse on these so-called phones, just a taped message. Disgruntled, I hung up and looked around to find the rest of the herd. They were gone. One of my father's biggest fears in moving to America was child kidnappings. Our hometown, Abadan, was about as safe a place as one could hope for. We knew all the neighbors, everyone looked out for everyone else's kids, and there was basically no crime other than petty theft. Whenever my relatives came to visit us in America, they would watch the evening news a few times and then refuse to leave the house. "It's too dangerous here," they always said. "Why are there so many shootings?" In Iran, citizens do not have access to guns, so we do not have the types of crimes that so often lead to murders in America. My father was acutely aware of the dangers inherent in our new surroundings and lectured me regularly on the perils of strangers and how I should always go to the police if I ever needed help. There were no police officers in Disneyland, so instead, I opted for the young man in the powder blue jumpsuit wearing the hat that resembled an inverted origami boat. "I'm lost," I told him. "Okay," he said in a kind voice. "Can you tell me what your parents look like?" I told him. "Now, can you tell me what your parents are wearing?" he asked. No 7-year-old, except maybe a young Giorgio Armani, could tell you what his parents were wearing on a given day. After my failure to answer the clothing question, Mr. Polyester escorted me to a small building near the main entrance. This was the Lost and Found, a place that, not surprisingly, I had never noticed during my previous visits. Once I entered the room, I started to cry. Several women surrounded me and asked me my name, which I, in the midst of my mucus-choked sobs, had to repeat several times. "What kind of name is that?" one of them asked. It was as if I was doomed to answer the same questions over and over again for the rest of my life. "I'm from Iran," I sniffled. "How nice," she said. From the look on her face, I could tell she had no idea where that was. Another one complimented me on my English. Then they told me not to worry. I could just sit down here and color while I waited for my parents to come and get me. I continued to cry. The 3 women tried to comfort me, but by then I had decided to cry the whole time. A few minutes later, the door opened, and in came a screaming boy who looked to be a few years younger than I. As Team Comfort rushed to his side, it became apparent that this boy spoke no English. No matter what the women said to him, he just screamed. When asked his name, he shook his head and cried louder. In desperation, one of the employees turned around and started walking toward me with a big, "I have a great idea" smile on her face. I knew what was coming. "Is that boy from your country?" she asked me. "Why, yes," I wanted to tell her. "In my country, which I own, this is National Lose Your Child at Disneyland Day." "No," I told her, "he's not from my country." I had no idea where the screamer was from, but I knew he wasn't Iranian. A gerbil would never mistake a hamster for a gerbil, and I would never mistake a non-Iranian for an Iranian. Despite the belief of most Westerners that all Middle Easterners look alike, we can pick each other out of a crowd as easily as my Japanese friends pick out their own from a crowd of Asians. It's like we have a certain radio frequency that only other Iranian radars pick up. After a few futile attempts to communicate with the boy, another one of the women came to me and asked me if I could please, in my language, ask that boy his name. I told her that I spoke Persian, and I was certain that the boy did not. The woman then knelt down and got real close to my face, skills picked up during coercion 101. Speaking very slowly, she told me that she needed me to do her a favor. I could tell she was trying to remember my name. She was thinking hard. "Sweetie?" she finally said, choosing to sidestep the name like a soldier avoiding a landmine. "Could you just try to talk to him? Will you do it for Mickey?" I wanted to tell her that Mickey was the reason I was lost in the first place. Had I not been trying to talk to him on those so-called phones, I wouldn't be sitting here. I didn't know that rodent anything. I once again told her that I spoke Persian, and I could just tell that the boy could not. "Could you just try?" she pleaded. Just to get rid of her, I walked up to the boy, who, breaking all stamina records, was still crying, and said in Persian, "Shuma Irani astid? Are you Iranian?" The boy stopped crying for a moment, then let out the loudest scream heard since biblical times. Not only was he separated from his loved ones, he was now trapped in the Tower of Babel. Although I was sorry for the little boy, I also felt vindicated. I went back to my coloring book, no longer feeling the urge to cry. I colored a few pages, then lo and behold, in walked my father, looking completely panicked and breathless. He ran and hugged me and asked me whether I had cried. "Of course not," I answered. He told me that I had gotten lost just when the group split in two, so an hour went by before anyone noticed I was missing. "I thought you had been kidnapped," he told me, still out of breath. Timing is key, and I knew this was my moment. "Could we go to the gift shop?" I asked. "Anything you want," he said. "Anything at all." We had to leave Disneyland early that day because my father was too weak in the knees to continue. Even the thought of Pirates of the Caribbean could not revive him. We spent the usual half hour looking for our car in the parking lot. I clutched closely two helium balloons, items my father prior to this visit had always called a waste of money and never bought for me, a two-foot-long pencil with scenes from Disneyland, a complete set of miniature plastic Seven Dwarfs with their own carrying case, and a Winnie the Pooh pencil holder. In the midst of my father's newfound appreciation for me, I also asked him if he would take me to the Movieland Wax Museum the following week. "Sure," he said, "anything you want." My father spent the drive home recreating my actions in his absence. "How did you know for sure you were lost?" he asked. "I couldn't see you guys," I answered. "How did you know whom to go to?" he continued. "I looked for someone who worked there." "How did you know he worked there and he wasn't just standing around looking for lost kids?" He had the same outfit as the other six people around him, and he had a name tag. "A name tag, huh? Very clever." I knew what he was thinking. Thanks to Mickey, I had been elevated from child who can't learn to swim to child genius. The following weekend, standing in the Movieland Wax Museum gift shop, I was having a hard time deciding among the visor, the inflatable mini pool with the museum logo, and the deck of cards emblazoned with four different movie stars. Then I heard my father utter the magic phrase, "Why don't we just get all of them?" "Good idea," I said, hoping his newly generous view of useless purchases was more than a passing phase. We left the gift shop with my father holding firmly onto my hand, just as he had done the entire day. Clutching my purchases with my other hand, I basked in my new status as favorite child. Perhaps I did owe that rodent something. Swoosh, swoosh. Every family has a daredevil. In my father's family, the honor goes to Uncle Nematullah, whose daring feat consisted of selecting his own wives three times. Marriage in my culture has nothing to do with romance. It's a matter of logic. If Mr. and Mrs. Ahmadi like Mr. and Mrs. Nejati, then their children should get married. On the other hand, if the parents don't like each other, but the children do, well, this is where sad poetry comes from. As odd as these logical unions may appear to the Western world, their success rate is probably no worse than that of marriages based on eyes meeting across a crowded room and the heart going va, 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 boom. After my uncle's second divorce, he decided to take a break from his medical practice in Ahvaz and come visit us in Whittier. For my American friends, a visiting relative meant a three-night stay. In my family, relative stays were marked by seasons, not nights. No one bothered coming halfway around the world for just the month of December. Might as well stay to experience spring in California, the children's graduation ceremonies in June, and Halloween. It didn't matter that our house was barely big enough for us. My father's motto has always been, "Job edele," room in the heart, room in the house. As charming as this sounds, it translates into a long line for the bathroom and extra loads of laundry for my mother. My father and his younger brother, Nematullah, share many interests, none stronger than the love of new foods. Some experience a foreign land through museums or historical sites, but for our family, America was to be experienced through the taste buds. Every day, Kazem and Nematullah, like cavemen headed for the hunt, would drive to the local supermarket, returning with cans and boxes of mysterious American products. They picked foods for the pictures on the containers, inadvertently proving that American marketing is sometimes better than American cooking. Since Iranian flavors are quite different from the flavors found in American convenience foods, most of the purchases ended up in the trash can. In Iran, meal preparation took up half of each day, starting early in the morning with my mother telling our servant, Zahra, which vegetables to clean and cut. The vegetables were either grown in our garden or had been purchased the day before. The ingredients in our meals were limited to what was in season. Summer meant eggplant or okra stew, fresh tomatoes, and tiny cucumbers that I would peel and salt. Winter meant celery or rhubarb stew, cilantro, parsley, fenugreek, and my favorite fruit, sweet lemon, which is a thin-skinned aromatic citrus not found in America. There was no such thing as canned, frozen, or fast food. Everything, except for bread, which was purchased daily, was made from scratch. Eating meant having to wait for hours for all the ingredients to blend together just right. When the meal was finally ready, we all sat together and savored the sensuous experience of a delicious Persian meal. Upscale restaurants in America, calling themselves innovative and gourmet, prepare food the way we used to. In Iran, it was simply how everybody ate. As Zahra began frying the onions and vegetables each morning, delicious smells wafted through our house. She and her husband Ali, who was our gardener, lived in a small house on our property. Unlike America, where only the very wealthy have live-in servants, in Iran, even middle-class families employ full-time help. Ali and Zahra were from a small village in northern Iran. With us, they could earn more money than was possible back home. They were very happy, and even though my parents found them another family to live with, no one cried harder than they did when we moved to America. After several weeks of trying every TV dinner, canned good, and cereal, my father and uncle concluded that the only ready-made American foods worth buying were canned chili, ice cream, and Chips Ahoy cookies. The rest, they concluded, was too salty, too sweet, or just plain bad. They next set out to explore the unknown territory of American fast food. We lived near a strip mall well supplied with restaurants, all of which took a similar high-grease approach to cooking. Starting at one end, we ate our way through the mall, skipping only a hot dog place called Der Wiener Schnitzel. The name was unpronounceable, and we had no interest in dogs, hot or otherwise. After weeks of research, we concluded that Kentucky Fried Chicken was the best thing we had tasted in America, followed by Baskin-Robbins, every last one of its flavors. No one was made happier by our foray into eating prepared foods than my mother, who, lacking both Iranian ingredients and Zahra, had a very difficult time cooking in America. The Colonel's secret recipe had set my mother free. Several times a week, my father would buy a couple of buckets of fried chicken on his way home from work. We'd fight over the crispy crumbs at the bottom and wash it all down with Coke. On other nights, we ate pizza, marveling at the stretchy cheese and our insatiable appetite for this wondrous food. A couple of months after my uncle's arrival, he realized that somehow none of the clothes in his suitcase fit him. He had spent the past